I joke about this, but it's literally happened to me more than once where like I've sat in the dentist office and like picked up the coffee table book and like the images in that book become inspiration for something I'm shooting.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we go. Another episode of Story and Craft. Thank you so much for stopping back by. Hey, if this is your first episode, hi, I'm Mark Preston. And today, we're all going to sit down and have a conversation with the lovely, the talented Jennifer Morrison. Been acting since she was 13 years old. You probably know her as an adult actor in TV shows like House, This Is Us, Once Upon a Time, How I Met Your Mother. But the cool thing about Jennifer, she is also a very accomplished TV director. Done film as well, but you probably know projects she's worked on like Euphoria, Joe Pickett. Also, right now, she's directed a number of episodes for the new season of Dr. Death. Just rolled out the new season on Peacock. She is a blast to speak with about the industry. It's kind of a micro masterclass and the TV industry and you know, half of the name of this program is Craft. So this is one of those craft days. Also, everything you could possibly ever want to know about Story and Craft, just go to storyandcraftpod.com. Check out information about all of our guests. Check out past episodes. Shoot me a note if you would like. Love the messages. Also, if you would like to send an email, don't forget the address you can shoot the email to. It gets right to me. It's hello@storyandcraftpod.com. All right, so let's jump right into it. Today, it's Jennifer Morrison Day right here on Story and Craft. Where are you located right now?
I'm in Los Angeles.
Is that where you're originally from, or are you a California kid, or?
I mean, I've lived here longer than anywhere else, but I grew up in the Chicago suburbs. And then I moved to Los Angeles in 2000.
Now, well, I always have to ask people from the Chicago area, Lou Malnati's or Giordano's, which one is your place?
Lou Malnati's.
Okay.
Yeah. Malnati's for sure.
I was looking over a little bit of your, obviously, wonderful acting career. The directing thing, was that always like a conscious thing? Were you always like, I want to direct someday? Or is it just kind of a natural evolution over time throughout your career?
Yeah. I have to say it's a little bit of both. I started directing theater really young. I started directing community theater when I was in high school. The very first production I ever directed was The Who's Tommy at the community theater near me, which was an aggressive first production. And then when I went to college, I directed some theater. And even when I moved out to LA, I directed some theater. And then I got cast on the show House, and my life became, you know, 20 hours a day for 6 years. That was my life. And so I wasn't directing as much. But what I was realizing was that I could use set as a way to learn all the technical stuff to potentially be a filmmaker as well. So I really had that experience of directing theater and then used being on set for House and Warrior and How I Met Your Mother and Once Upon a Time. You know, I kind of just used all those sets as my film school in terms of asking people questions and really studying the technical side of things.
I look at the director. I mean, you're really picking things up from way before the production starts to well after. I mean, it's almost like being an actor is way easier of a gig, it seems like, you know, because you show up for your day, you do your thing, and you get to go home, you know. You know, and TV is a pretty aggressive production schedule, it seems like.
It is.
Kind of going back to the beginning, gone origin story type thing. You said you directed community theater in high school. Were you a theater kid, or was theater always your thing, or were you kind of going, I want to be on TV one day or movies?
No, theater was my thing. You're right. That was a good guess. Yes, I was a theater kid. I loved being on stage. I was going to Saturday school, like creative Saturday school things that I don't remember what it was actually called, but we would just call it Saturday school, where I was doing plays there. And then did all the school plays and all the plays in high school and the musicals and all that stuff. So that was really where my heart was. And that's ultimately, I majored in theater and English in college. So for me, my life really centered around theater. And
where did you go to school?
Loyola in Chicago. Which ended up being a really great school for me to go to.
Did they have a pretty robust program, or when you came out of school, were you focusing on just doing local theater, or what were you up to after your Loyola time?
Well, so part of the reason I ended up at Loyola, and like I said, really happy I ended up there. I really appreciate the education I got there, was because they were willing to let me work as an actor while I was there. And I was already working as an actor because I did my first film when I was 13 and I already had representation and stuff. So I wanted to go to a school that was going to let me continue my career. Whereas, like, you know, I'd gotten into Northwestern and DePaul and other schools that I really admired and thought maybe I'd want to go to, but they were conservatory programs where they weren't going to let you work professionally while you were actually in school. And Loyola was not a conservatory program. And they also had really wonderful professors there at the time for theater. And there was no graduate program. So it meant that as an undergraduate, I didn't have to compete with graduate students for roles. And so it gave me an opportunity to really be actually on stage acting a lot more. And like I said, because I had an agent and had already sort of gotten into the industry before that, I did three films. I was in three films while I was in college, and they really accommodated the schedule to help me do that. And so when I graduated, I really had to make a decision because my heart was that I really wanted to go to New York and try to be on stage. But I also knew how lucky I was that I had an agent in Los Angeles and that I sort of had, you know, a little bit of a head start having been a kid actor. And I was like, I think I need to do LA while I'm young and hope that, you know, whatever success comes from that or experience comes from that will also lend me the opportunity to eventually go to New York. And so luckily that is what happened. I mean, I ended up having a place in New York for 12 years and I've done plays in New York as well now, but I just did it a little bit later. You know, I went to LA first once I graduated.
When you were 13, what kind of a role was this? Was this a movie or was it a TV show or?
Yeah. So I played Richard Gere and Sharon Stone's daughter in the film Intersection. And Mark Rydell was the director and Vilmos Zsigmond was the cinematographer. It was like a really wild, amazing group of just veteran everything to be introduced to that world through. I think Mark Rydell had just come off of directing On Golden Pond and, you know, Vilmos Zsigmond has shot some of the most epic movies ever. So I got that from making a tape in Chicago and sending that in. And then they flew me out to Vancouver where we shot the movie. And I met with Mark Rydell and had auditions there and then ultimately got cast.
I'm trying to remember that the wife was cheating on him or it was, am I thinking of the right movie?
It opens with a car crash. So it was like a big car crash. Yeah. And then he's pulled between Lolita Davidovich and Sharon Stone's character. And he's sort of, honestly, I would have to go back and watch it to tell you the whole story because I don't think I've seen it since I was like 15. But yeah, it was Sharon and Lolita and Richard and me.
Being 13 and doing that, what were your folks thinking? Were they supportive of this thing their daughter was diving into, or were they kind of, I don't know about this?
I was really lucky. You know, my parents are both teachers, and I think for them, they're both music teachers. So they understood that I was interested in being creative. And their attitude was always, you know, if you're doing well in school and you're paying attention to your studies, you can do this for fun. And I think that was a great way to be introduced to it because I never had that pressure. You know, I didn't have stage parents. I didn't have someone forcing me to do it. And I also didn't have someone fighting me terribly. It was just, if this is something you enjoy and it's something that you love and we can make it work while you're still also taking your studies seriously, then you can do it. And so I think that was a really nice way for me to be introduced to all that. It kept a nice balance in my life.
Yeah. You know, whenever I speak to young actors, the kid actors, it's always nice when they've got the fire. They're the ones like really wanting to do it. It always gets, I know in times I've done projects and I've been on sets with kids who have this traditional stage parents, it's always uncomfortable. You know, yeah. I always feel for those kids because I teach voiceover as well. And sometimes I can tell when I get a student and they're not really into it. It's just something their parent wanted them to do. And I think you got to really have that internal fire. You got to really want to do it yourself. Now, as you were coming up, you know, let's say you get to House. And by the way, I have a good friend of mine who's a commander in the Coast Guard. I think he knows every episode by heart.
Wow.
And he's going to lose his mind when I tell him I talk to you. So you mentioned earlier, it kind of altered the trajectory of kind of where you're at. How do you, What was that experience like with House, working on a the schedule? What was that like? And was it kind of where you wanted to be?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to be there. I was always up for a lot of pilots. I had done pilots before that didn't go. And Bryan Singer was directing the pilot. I learned a tremendous amount from him as a director. And obviously that group of actors was just incredible. Hugh Laurie is extraordinary, and Lisa Edelstein and Jesse Spencer and Omar Epps. And it was just such a great ensemble to be a part of. And it was such a great way to be a young actor learning, you know, when you're going toe to toe with Hugh Laurie every day, when you're 20 something and you're getting to learn from all of his experience. It was really incredible. But it was tough. It was a tough show. I mean, this was back in the day when no one cared about how abusive the hours were. And we really were working sometimes 20-hour days. We were really excited about like an 16 to 18-hour day.
You said you're excited for a 16 to 18-hour day?
Oh, yeah. That was a good day.
Vincent D'Onofrio, I heard an interview with him. And he was talking about how when he was doing what he's doing, that back then, like you said, it was kind of untethered. You just
go forever.
Was it nonstop working, or was there just a lot of waiting for them to set up the next scene?
No, it was a combination of things. I mean, it was a lot. I mean, when you think about like every show is different, and the reason the hours are long are different. But like for House, a lot of it was just that every room was a glass box. So you're constantly trying to deal with all the reflections that could happen. You know, everything reflects in everything because you've got glass in every direction. And then you've got five or six people in the room, and then you're covering five or six people in every scene. And it was just, it's just a lot that had to be accomplished in the day. And plus we all had to know all this medical dialogue. So it was like, you know, you would have this 18-hour day, and then you'd go home and be memorizing medical words for the next day. And then they would force your call. Like it's a thing called force calls where you're supposed to have 12 hours off from set to set in terms of like, turnaround, and they can ask to pay you a little bit extra to make it 10 hours instead of 12. And the crazy thing about that is by the time you drive out home 45 minutes, and then you drive to set 45 minutes. And so that's another hour and a half that you've lost. And then, you know, you go home and you need to memorize for an hour, and you need to eat, and you need to, you know, it's like you literally are only home for barely enough time to like memorize, sleep for 6 hours if you're lucky, and then turn around and go back to work. So it was just, you know, it's the old days, luckily. I mean, I think that they've really done a good job of trying to keep things more to 12 to 14 hour days, which is much more humane. But it, you know, back then it was just, that was my whole life. I don't have a lot of memories from that time.
Thank you, SAG-AFTRA.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it back then, were you becoming more intrigued with what was happening, like with the grips, the lighting, the camera, the, you know, was that something you were just inherently paying attention to as if naturally a future director? I mean, was that something that already intrigued you, or how did the directorial vibe kind of bubble up with?
Yeah, I mean, I had always been such a lover of cinema. You know, I had my favorite films that I would carry around on DVD when I'd be out of town working and things like that, and watch the movies that I loved over and over and over again, and watch the, you know, the special things behind the scenes and all of the commentaries and read about it and all of it. And, you know, was really just kind of doing the best I could to put myself through film school, honestly. You know, I was looking at film school syllabuses and looking at what they watched and watching those things. And then when I was curious about something or didn't understand something, you know, I would use the cinematographer on set as like a resource, or I would talk to the grip, or I would talk to the dolly grip, or I would, you know, ask the gaffer. And, you know, I realized that people who love what they do love talking about what they do. And so it became just this incredible film school for me. And that was started on the set of House, but then, you know, continued once I was working on Once Upon a Time and working on the film Warrior, and being able to sort of talk to Gavin O'Connor about some of that stuff as well. And, you know, just, I was very lucky because I've worked with probably over 200 television directors, and I've worked with about 30 film directors, and I've gotten to really just take all the good and the bad from them, you know, like learn from both the good and the bad, and sort of hone my skills and ask all the right questions. And I think the biggest thing that I took away from the directors that I really admired was just that they were really honest about what they knew and what they didn't know. And I think a lot of times you have directors who feel like they have to act like they know everything. And the truth is you've got an entire team of people to know things with you and for you. So if you're just sort of honest about all that, you end up in a position where you can learn a lot and also you can contribute a lot.
Well, when you said you were looking at the syllabi or of the film schools, were there movies or TV shows or something that you watched that really kind of informed, like, yeah, that's kind of my style. That you kind of held on to and kind of made part of your own like directorial DNA. Was there anything out there that you really loved like that?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that was really influential for me was there is a book of interviews with Scorsese. It's like 400 pages of pure interview. And he talks so much about craft, like actually talks about craft. And I've always been really in awe of and admiring of his way that he uses the camera to tell story visually and moves the camera. He knows when to move the camera. He knows when not to move the camera. You know, he's just a very effective visual storyteller and really creative with how he uses the camera. And so it was just really, that became kind of a North Star for me in terms of just like conversation about craft. And so, you know, I admire a lot of those movies from the 70s. You know, I like that kind of vibe of like using the camera to be a character in the story.
Yeah, I do kind of like that when they do that in TV now, when you kind of feel like you are an additional observer in the scene. I kind of dig the, I don't know what you would call it, the action of it or the kinetic vibe that you get from it. But looking back at your career now, as far as the TV, like House, were you given the opportunity to direct any of the episodes?
So here's the thing. And I feel like I get in trouble every time I say this, but it's just the truth. There is an unspoken attitude in the industry that is, if as an actor, the first thing you work on as a director is your own show, it was some sort of like gift that was given to you and everybody else made it happen and you didn't really direct. And I was not interested in having that stigma attached to the way that I wanted to be a filmmaker and the way that I wanted to be able to contribute as a filmmaker. And so I don't think that I was probably in a place where that would have even been offered to me. I was in a place where that would have been offered to me by Once Upon a Time. But I very, very intentionally did not direct anything I was on because I wanted to climb through that experience the way that a filmmaker does, you know? So like I made a short film first and I submitted that to festivals and then that went to festivals. And then I worked on some music videos and I worked on an anthology series for Refinery 29. And I, you know, so I was really like cutting my teeth on all these things, like the way that you normally would. And then I really fought very hard to put my feature together and found the financing for that, made that film, sold it to Netflix. And so it was really important to me to kind of climb through that process organically and not be perceived as like, oh, well, she was just given this like favor of an episode. You know, it's not a fair thing because no matter what, you still have to direct.
That's interesting. So you really drew a line of delineation between you on camera, because I wonder what it's like to direct yourself and be in an episode. That's gotta be really rough to have that objectivity. You gotta trust, I guess, your DP to, you know, give you good, you know, got to trust somebody on the set to give you feedback on your own performance, I guess.
Yeah.
What, is there any genre that you kind of wanted to focus on in directing? Because you've covered, you know, some interesting, like Euphoria and, you know, you're dealing with young folk, you know, and then is there any specific genre you like to stick to or do you like to do it all?
Not necessarily. I mean, I really looked at television as an opportunity to try every genre. You know, my feature Sundogs is very much like an underdog story. It's very like, it's a very traditional American film, I feel like, you know, it on purpose. I grew up loving things like The Graduate and loving things like Miracle, Groundhog Day, Rudy, What About Bob, you know, like just those like, you know, kind of all American heartfelt, you know, movies. And I wanted to find something that had that energy to it. Whereas with television, I felt like here's a chance to go work on all different levels of budgets with all different kind of technical requirements, with all different kinds of casts, and really just get the experience of trying all of it. And so, you know, Euphoria, I got to work with P.T. Anderson's crew. I got to work with Sam Levinson, who's a genius. Like it was just all movement. It was a masterclass in movement and how to achieve really difficult shots. And then, you know, to go and work on like Joe Pickett, which is a Western, and be able to really like work with horses and animals and out in the wilderness and like with landscape, and then do Grease, Rise of the Pink Ladies and direct a musical and figure out what that looks like and all the technical things that go into accomplishing a musical, and then do Surface, which is a thriller. So it was like what my team and I were really looking for from a from a directing perspective on television in the last few years has been, how do I do as many different genres as aggressively as possible? Just because I really wanted to be inside those worlds and really experience what was required of those different genres. And so I think that I think Sundogs is always going to look like a North Star for the kind of films that I make. But what excites me is kind of moving from genre to genre on television.
You know, it sounds like you don't have any free time. I'm like thinking of the timeline of these projects. I'm like, you don't have a lot of time off. Do you have like, do you want to carve out space and go, you know, I want to do some time on camera. I want to work on some projects and then come back to directing? Or are you kind of, is there like a pendulum that swings for you, or is it just sort of whatever?
You know, it's a good question. And I think it's probably depends on what moment you ask me that question, what the answer is to it. But really the sort of grounding force that I feel I look to when I'm trying to make a decision about whether I'm acting or directing or what project's next is really, who am I working with? You know, we all get to do the coolest thing in the world. We get to like do what we love all day, every day. And unfortunately, that doesn't mean you're always in a great environment. It should mean that, but not every set is a happy set. And so what's really important to me is looking at the team of people that I'm going to work with. So, you know, if a job comes up or an opportunity comes up as an actor where I'm really inspired by the showrunner and the writers and the other actors and the whole group, like I will jump at that. That was This Is Us for me. You know, I was dying to work with Dan Fogelman and I loved all those actors and I loved the show. And so that was a no-brainer of like, yes, I will carve out the time to do this. And I feel very lucky to be here and to even be asked to be here. And then same thing with directing. You know, it's like, who's the showrunner? Who's the cinematographer? What's the creative team? Who's the production designer? Like, what's this cast look like? So for me, the decisions right now are a lot more about not, it's not so much, am I going to act or am I going to direct? It's what opportunities are available to me and what's the ecosystem that I might be joining. And so I'm really like looking at that kind of creative collaboration. And I move toward like the places where I'm really inspired.
I just feel like you have so much more energy than I don't know. You have a great collage of things you're working on, but you're constantly active. I mean, what are you doing when you you are not doing something creative mm-hmm. on or behind the camera? What are you doing to kind of fill up your days usually?
I feel like I am just sort of a creative being. So much of my life is just kind of accumulating inspiration, right? You know, it's like, I feel like I joke about this, but it's literally happened to me more than once where like I've sat in the dentist office and like picked up the coffee table book and like the images in that book become inspiration for something I'm shooting. You know, it's just, I feel like if you're open to it, you can sort of collage inspiration in your life. And so I think a lot of the time spent for me when I'm not on a set, you know, even if I am trying to take care of errands or whatever, is also just trying to stay open to those different influences and letting things accumulate inside of me so that I have that well of creativity to use when I'm working. But I also, you know, like I work out and I spend time with my family. I love hiking. You know, it's great to live in LA because there's always a pretty decent hike nearby. It's nice when there's time that I can travel with my family. Like that's something that's always really nice. But I would say like, you know, my husband and I love watching stuff together. We always have shows that we're watching together. We always have a list of movies that we're working our way through. Like our life is really very much centered around, either working or finding inspiration for work. And we just love it. So like, it doesn't feel like work when you love it.
Now, is your husband in the industry as well?
He is. Yeah. Yeah. No, he's an actor. He's an actor. Yeah.
Do y'all try to work in such a way where you're both not working on a pretty intense project at the same time? Or do you just kind of take it as it comes to you?
No, I mean, it's worked out really well. I think, you know, it's part of the joy of both being in the industry is that you really understand, you know, like we would never take it personally and we would never be offended by the time that needs to be spent on a project, you know, and we do really try to be there for each other. You know, it's like there's different things that we need from each other on different projects. And I think that that's been a really beautiful part of our partnership is just, you know, it's like, okay, what do you need from me on this one? You need me to like give you space so that you can think and, you know, be alone, or you need me to be there to run lines with you every night, or, you know, so we have found creative ways to do that for each other when we can't be in the same city. Thank God for, you know, Zoom and FaceTime and all the things, because now I think you can be a lot more present. I'm sure it'll continue to get more complicated as our lives continue and different jobs come up, but, you know, it's like if I'm directing something and he's acting on something, oftentimes he's the one who's like, I get it. I know you're basically working 24/7. So like he'll ask for a Friday off so he can fly to me, you know, and then vice versa. You know, it's like if I'm, you know, if I'm not, if I'm in prep and I'm not actually on set at that moment, and I have a little bit more time, but he's got a really intense role, then I'll try to fly to him. And there's also been times where we've just, you know, it's turned out that he's had time off while I was directing something and he's been able to come and stay with me for a stretch. So we just make the best of it, you know? And like I said, it's the lucky part of both being in the industry is that we do at least understand what each other is going through.
Is he down with you directing him in a project? Is that something he's kind of like, you know, I don't know about that. Or is he kind of cool with it?
No, he would love that. Like he's like, my husband's the best. He really is. He's an incredible human being. And like, he's such a, I mean, he's an incredible human being and like a great talent. And he's incredibly egoless with me when I direct him, which is incredible, because I think that that's a really tough thing to do in a partnership. But he really trusts me. And yeah, a lot of the directing has just been on like self tapes to get jobs and things like that. But it goes really well, you know, like we make a good team when it comes to that stuff. So it's been, oh, there he is. I was just bragging about you. Sorry, he just walked through. So,
you know, it's funny. Not funny, but I've talked with folks that now you had this kind of 3-month gap during the strike. How did you fill up your time during that?
Oh yeah, I mean it's obviously a whole other thing. Yeah, I mean the thing is, a lot of it was just us being able to have time together and with our family, which is incredible, and we try to take advantage of things like that. You know, obviously we wouldn't wish the strike on the industry or on us or on anyone. And we really want to be back to work too. But you know, we did try to take advantage of the fact that we could be home together, living in our house and being a family and really enjoying that. And,
yeah, it's a mixed blessing, then, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And also, you know, there's so many things that I have had, so many plates spinning that I have as a director that didn't necessarily stop during that time. You know, I mean, we couldn't cast anything and it couldn't actually go into production, but you know, there's all sorts of other things that were being asked of my mind creatively for some of the projects that I'm attached to as a filmmaker. So, so that did fill some of it and, you know, traveling a little bit and all that stuff.
Well, on Dr. Death, you know, like in movies, it's really a director's medium. And they say on TV, it's a writer's medium. But you look at some of these shows and kind of the way things are done, and especially if you're directing multiple episodes, you really get to kind of put your thumbprint on that. What was kind of your idea and kind of like, how did it come to you? And also kind of how did you kind of put your own thumbprint on what this was all about this season?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, Dr. Death is an anthology series. So each season is a different cast and a different story that's being told. So it's exciting because even though there is this kind of like heartbeat of a through line of each season is a doctor that has done something terrible within the system and kind of gotten away with it, each year it really starts over. So the first year was about this doctor, Dr. Dunch, and I actually directed episodes 3 and 4 of the first season when Patrick McManus was the showrunner for that season. And worked with, you know, Alec Baldwin, Christian Slater, Josh Jackson, great cast, Grace Gummer. And I got 2 episodes where it was sort of a really big visual concept for those 2 episodes, because a huge section of it was like this fantasy sequence that needed to feel like it wasn't real. And so I really got to put a visual stamp on that because of the fantasy sequence of it all. And that went really well. And I got along so well with Patrick. And then when season 2 was being conceived and they decided to do the Paolo Macchiarini story and they needed someone to pilot the second season and do the first 4 episodes, you know, I think because of how sort of visual those episodes were that I ended up directing in the first go around of the anthology series, they thought of me for this. And I met with Ashley Michael Hoban, who's a showrunner on this one. And she was just incredible. And we had a great collaboration. And I just attribute both Patrick and Ashley Michael as just being just such collaborative partners. Like you were saying, like sometimes the director is a little bit minimalized on television. And I don't think either of them would ever allow that, you know? So I was really grateful to feel like a real partner in that situation in both situations. And Ashley and Michael and I were just like so close and, we also had very similar taste and saw the show in such a similar way. So it was a great partnership. And I've learned over the years, like, it's really important to find that right partnership with your showrunners. You know, every showrunner is different. Every showrunner operates a little bit differently. Every showrunner is differently generous in terms of how much they let you put your stamp on things. But no matter what, they're the ones who conceived of it in their brain. So I'm doing the best I can to kind of climb inside their heads and try to bring to life this thing that they've been working on for sometimes years before I've even come to the project, you know? And so with the second season of Dr. Death, you know, it was just exciting to do the pilot. It was exciting to be a part of the casting process. It was wild because we shot all four episodes at once. So it was basically like making a 4-hour movie, and we had to cast, you know, 120 actors or something before we even started, because we were cross-boarding everything, which meant everybody had to be there and available. And it was really important to me that I wanted to still have the heartbeat and essence of what was established in the first season, but I wanted it to have its own look and its own vibe. And the story was so different that it was asking for a different energy. And so, you know, the Paolo Macchiarini character is kind of swirling people into misconceptions at all times, and he spins the truth all the time. And so there were times where movement was really important to keep the audience in a place of feeling that kind of whirlwind of energy. And then there were times where, because that was happening, stillness really meant something, you know. So you'll feel that there's a push and pull between movement and stillness in the show, and that was very much in the design.
Are you naturally a person who likes to prepare a lot? Because that's what seems like TV. And I don't know if I could ever direct, because I'm so, like, sometimes if I go to a restaurant with a big menu, I'm like a pain in the ass. I mean, like, I can't make my mind. And being a director, it's all about the choices, you know? So are you naturally somebody who just kind of really prepares a lot? So you walk in, it's you're ready to go day of.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. It's like, I am a big prepper, but that preparation is so that I can be flexible. You know, it's like, I always look at the preparation as the safety net. You know, it's like there's always something you don't expect on the day. There's always a crisis that you don't expect on the day that you're going to have to pivot and solve. And you can't be so stuck in your prep that you can't let go of it to adjust to the circumstances. But also there's going to be a moment of inspiration that you may not have seen coming. But as long as you have that preparation and you know you have a plan that can work, if you so choose to go with it, it gives you an efficiency to the way that you move through your day. And I think that that's the greatest gift a director can give themselves, is efficiency, because that means you have time for that shot that's a new inspiration, or you have time to have that extra take with the actor. So I really do believe in prep, but I also, it's very similar to how I think as an actor, which is you prep. And as soon as you're there on the day, you've got to let it all go and just be. And it's a similar thing, I think, as a filmmaker, which is like you prep, you're prepared, you're ready to go, you have that safety net, but you also have to let go and just be and let inspiration of the moment come. There's got to be a balance between preparation and inspiration.
What is the next thing on your agenda? Is it going to be a directing project? Is it going to be on camera? Do you already have something lined up that you're wanting to do?
You know, I don't know, because I originally was asked to be the producing director for Grease, Rise of the Pink Ladies for the second season. And then with all of the stuff that happened with the strike and all the complexities of all that stuff, that show ended up getting canceled. So the job I had lined up is no longer there. So I'm attached to a Netflix movie that just isn't greenlit yet to direct. And I have two projects that I'm about to take to market as a director. And I'm writing a script that I'm hoping to direct as well, that has producers already on board and financing and all that. So I have all these things that are sort of percolating, but I don't have like the next Dr. Death job that I can say for sure is coming. So it's just a matter of like which thing actually falls into place, hopefully early next year.
Maybe a vacation. Maybe I'm hearing all the stuff you're doing going, gosh, I need to be more efficient with my time.
Well, I did just have a strike. I had plenty of vacation on this strike. So I'm ready. I'm ready to work in January.
So as we kind of wrap up here, I do a little something I call my 7 questions, kind of my favorite, one of my favorite parts of the little shindig I do every week.
Nice.
Just kind of a little extra get to know you. One of the questions I like to always ask, because I'm a big food, I kind of started off with the Giordano's and Malnati's question, but
yeah,
what is your favorite comfort food?
I love pasta. Like I love like a great bolognese, and I'm not picky. It could be probably from anywhere. I'm fine with like, you know, like one of our favorite restaurants in New York is Rosdora, which is like this extraordinary Michelin star Italian restaurant. So like you can take me there and give me, you know, a ragu, or you could also take me to Olive Garden, and I'm either way, you give me pasta and it's my comfort.
You know, sometimes you just need just a big bowl of pasta, some just average wine, and just, you know, Olive Garden sometimes satisfies that, you know, but just need a carb overload, you know, it soothes the soul.
Totally. Now
the next question I got is, if you're going to sit down, you got like a few hours to sit down with three people to sit down and talk story, who would those three people be at the table with you, living or not? Actually, who would you like to sit down with?
I think one of the people I would love to sit down with is Greta Gerwig. I think she's so brilliant and just so has her finger on the pulse of really interesting, unique work right now as a filmmaker. So I'd say Greta Gerwig for sure. And like maybe Lois Weber. She was like, so she's not alive, but she was in the early days was writing, directing, producing all her own stuff. She was the first woman to start her own studio. Really just like a pioneer in the industry and was just like a force as a filmmaker. And I think had she been a male who did what she did, we'd all be talking about her differently. But like she was just a really, really fascinating.
It's kind of like a Lucille Ball sort of.
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
Now, who would the third person be? Maybe Martin Scorsese, you know.
Oh, sorry, three. You said three. I was thinking I was.
Yeah,
Scorsese. Yeah, exactly. I would say Scorsese, Greta Gerwig, and Lois Weber. That'll be a great conversation.
It would be quite educational, without a doubt. Now, I do want to go to the third question, which is when you were a kid, who was your first celebrity crush? That first person that just captivated you?
There was that movie, the Ladybug movie. It was like a soccer movie. I think Keira Knightley was maybe in it. And I think his name was Jonathan Brandis. I don't think he's actually alive anymore, sadly, but like blonde hair, cute kid. Like I just remember having a crush on him.
Yeah,
his birthday
was
the day after mine. His birthday was April 13th. And I somehow thought that meant like, you know, it was fate for sure.
Yeah. When you're a kid, you're like, oh, did we share a birthday? I'm you know, it's always funny. Like thinking of people you share birthdays with, somehow like you should all get a convention going with each other.
Right.
If you were to live on the next question, if you live on an exotic island, it's not like you're not some castaway. It's maybe a nice resort or whatever, but there's no streaming. Uh-huh. There's no internet. You have to bring a DVD of a movie and a CD of your favorite album or something you listen to over and over and watch over. So what would that DVD and what would that CD be for you?
I think the DVD would probably be The Graduate. I feel like I go back to that movie a lot for a lot of different reasons. I really like that film. Yeah. And I love the way that I love the craftsmanship of it, but I also love the story and I love the characters. And I feel like there's just always, I feel like every time I watch that, something new presents itself to me. And I really enjoy that. And in terms of a CD, I would take Beck's Morning Face, which is just a beautiful album that I feel like is, I feel like a lot of albums now are not like complete. They're not like start to finish where you need to hear the whole thing together to feel its experience.
Right, right.
And that's one of the few albums I think in the last, you know, 10 years that is like very much like an album that is a complete thought. You know?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good point. After spending some time in radio, you know, last time was my heyday at radio, it was like the 90s, but music radio, that is. And the thing is, it seems like they would always put out an album with only really two songs that were that great. And then the rest was kind of fluff and they just were wanting to move CDs, you know, the record industry, you know, but you're right. The ones that kind of have this whole arc of a story really kind of make it special. If you were to question five here, if you were to say, perfect day, how would you define that from the time you get up to time you go to bed? What would be the component parts of a perfect day for you?
I think a little bit of balance. You know, I think if I, you know, you get up, you have your coffee, have a quiet morning where you're not rushed, be able to go to the gym, work out, maybe go for a hike or something if you don't want to go to the gym, spend time with my husband and family in there, maybe have lunch with everybody. And then spend some time on set. You know, it's like if you could be on set for maybe 4 hours a day, you know, and then like, you know, have a nice dinner at a nice restaurant, watch maybe a great episode of Welcome to Wrexham or something and go to bed at 10, you know. I'm a person of simple pleasures, clearly.
That's a very aspirational. Go to bed at 10. Oh, yeah, I don't know the last time I actually did that. But that would be wonderful. Now, last couple of questions. If you weren't doing what you were doing right now, what, you know, if in some cosmic universe you were not able to do this, what would be your second choice? What would you be doing for a living and how would you be occupying your day?
I think I would be an interior designer. I'm pretty sure. I really love it. Like, I've decorated so many homes and apartments over the years. And I, you know, my love of that kind of overflows into like working with production designers and stuff. So I think if I had to not be in the industry, I think I would definitely go to school for interior design.
Well, there you go. Instead of actors, it would be sofas.
Right. Exactly.
Now the last question, if you're to jump in your DeLorean and travel back in time to when you were 16, and you got a piece of advice or a bit of guidance or something to 16-year-old you to make your, in that moment, make your life better or set you on a different path, what would that piece of advice be?
I would just say have more fun. I was a really serious kid. Like I was always kind of serious and worried about everything adding up. And I think I would have just told myself to give myself a little bit of a break. But I wouldn't want to change my trajectory. Like, I definitely feel very grateful for the life that I have. And I do love my life. But I do think I could have relaxed a little bit younger.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you taking time out with me. And, you know, it's Friday, you know, you're kind of looking at the weekend. I appreciate you taking time out.
Of course.
You say you do a podcast as well?
I do. Yeah. So I have a book club through my production company, Apartment 3C, and it's called Jen's Bookshelf. And the podcast is called The Bookshelf with Jennifer Morrison. And I pick 10 books a year and we highlight them and I post, you know, quotes from the book and I interview the authors. And so the podcast is my interviews with the authors about their craftsmanship and about their approach and what their creative process is and where their ideas came from and the process of getting the book published and all that stuff.
Very good. You're a reader. Very good. I need to do more of that. I listen to audiobooks because regular books just put me to sleep, you know, so I got to do the audiobook thing while I'm driving. But I do appreciate your time and have a wonderful, hopefully relaxing weekend. Hopefully we'll have a chance to catch up down the line.
Thanks so much, Mark. Thank you. Have a great weekend. Bye.
All right, there you go. Jennifer Morrison enjoyed this chat quite a bit. I told you it was going to be kind of one of those crafty episodes, talking about how the sausage gets made, as it were. Instead of sausage, it's television, of course. But it was a blast speaking with her. I mean, she's been acting since she was 13, so it's, you know, she's had a good majority of her life in this industry. Don't forget to check out Jennifer's latest work, directed a number of episodes, Dr. Death, streaming right now on Peacock. The new season 2, just kicked off. Again, I want to thank you for stopping by. It means a lot to me that you pop in each week. And if this is your first episode again, hey, thanks for sticking with me and hanging out and, you know, great episodes to come. It's still a little bit up in the air. Maybe not an episode next week. We don't know. We're planning on it. Making a big move down to the South Texas coast. Going to be planting our studios on South Padre Island in Texas. That's where all this fun's going to emanate from going forward. So trying to live that Jimmy Buffett lifestyle. By the way, much love to Jimmy Buffett. I don't know if I ever sent out a little love and, you know, to the great beyond after he passed. But, you know, going to try to keep that vibe going. Flip-flops. You know how it goes. All right, so I tell you what, we will be back. If not next week, it'll be the week after. And I want to thank you again for being a part of what we have going on. Don't forget storyandcraftpod.com, the website. If you want to shoot me a note, by all means, just send it to hello@storyandcraftpod.com. Hey, have a great weekend. Again, thank you so much. Be safe. By the way, as I said, weekend. You may be listening to this during the week. Who knows? Whatever you're doing, thank you for making Story and Craft part of what you got going on. All right, we'll see you next time right here on Story and Craft. We'll see you soon.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.